Log Talk Radio.
When you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host Red Beckman and Dr. Kate tonight. I believe Red's going to be a few minutes late joining us, and we'll be glad to have him join in when he's here. As always, we like to start this show off with a prayer, so I am going to do the honors. Almighty Father in heaven, we just are always thankful that we can come before you and we have an audience before you because of the righteousness of your Son. We need you in this spiritual battle. We acknowledge that the battle we're fighting here is a spiritual battle at the deepest levels. And we know that we don't stand much of a chance without you going ahead of us. So we ask you to join us this night. We ask you to fill us with your Spirit, fill our listeners with your Spirit. We pray that what we do and say here will glorify you tonight. We pray that everything we do is in accordance with your will. I just pray that you open the hearts and the minds of our listeners tonight and help us to bring forth a message that will be productive and well-received. It's in the name of your Son, Yahshua HaMashiach, that we pray. Amen. All right. Do we have Steve Laffey on with us yet?
Amen. Amen, Terry.
Well, good evening, Steve. I was fortunate to meet Steve at the 4th Congressional District Assembly. I was a delegate for that. And outside the assembly itself, I saw these folks talking to a lot of people. And there was a very lovely lady there who was saying some very interesting things. And I got to visit with her for a little bit and found out about Steve Laffey. And boy, Steve, I tell you, you've got quite a salesperson there working the crowd for you.
Yes, my wife, my beautiful wife of, oh gosh, and three of the children were there. You didn't get the full Laffey Act in that they weren't all six children, but you the three children, three younger ones were there because we homeschool them, and they were there, and she loved talking with you. She said, "Come over here." So I'm glad we got a chance to meet and. That was a great day. It was a fun day. It's so great to be in a room with a lot of like-minded people once in a while.
Yes, it was. And I've got something playing in my ear here, so I got to figure out where that's coming from. Give me just a second, and I will find it and get it shut off because it's rather annoying to hear myself twice when I talk.
Oh, I've been there.
Got it. I have too many things. Anyway, I was very fortunate to pick up one of your movies that you created called Fixing America.
Yes.
Found that very interesting, and I can't believe the extent that you went to prepare that. I'm looking forward to asking you some questions about that. But before we get into that, Steve, you decided to run for the U.S. Congress here in Colorado, 4th District. Tell us a little bit about your background and what drove you to that decision.
Well, the short version of the background is I'm just a poor kid from Cranston, Rhode Island that was educated in the public schools. My dad was a toolmaker. We had a lot of issues in the family, but my oldest brother passed away of AIDS. He's one of the earliest people to get that. And my other brother had been locked up for quite some time. He just got out in a psychiatric unit, and my sister's in a group home with schizophrenia. My other sister, you know, that was the Flaffy family growing up. But the neighborhoods and the teachers and people took care of me, and I was just very blessed to end up at college. I mean, I my father didn't even want me to go to college. He didn't have any money. So I applied to a college. I happened to have a needs blind policy. I got in Bowdoin College in Maine. And then by the grace of God, I only applied to Harvard Business School because someone in my class told me you couldn't get in out of college. So I applied thinking, I'll just show him, I'll get in. And I did. But I had no money. And literally within a month of me getting in, a man died who had gone to Bowdoin College and Harvard Business School, and I received the first scholarship. So I went through 6 years of school, came out, really didn't have much of a student loan. I mean, just some extra stuff that my tuition was paid for. And I went down, I just didn't have any money, so I went to Wall Street. Because I figured, generally I was on Wall Street for the next 15 years. I was at Payne Webber. And then I met a man as in New York City yelling, screaming, throwing phones around, and like you see on TV. And the shortest version is I met a man named Alan Morgan. I was just so blessed. A man who had started a company, sort of the Merrill Lynch of the South, about $100 million in revenue when I met him. He hired me on the spot. I became his partner, and eventually I became the president, the chief operating officer, because I fixed all their financial problems. I ran the venture capital operations, and it was about a $500 million revenue firm when we sold it. And we sold it for about $780 million, and the shareholders was very happy. The employees all stayed. I was the one who left. And I thought I'd start a hedge fund and make some more money, but I was at a Christian camp in upstate New York because five of my classmates from business school had gone there, and they invited me down, and my wife and I and the kids, we went down there, and I just got out of my heart. It's a funny story, but they start talking about where you were from, and I said Cranston. I wasn't going back, but it just grew like a mustard seed. About a month later, I was writing to my high school principal. A couple of days later, I had this sort of vision. I should go back, and I did, and the city of Cranston went basically bankrupt, and I became the mayor. I can skip that, skipping like a year and a half of stuff, but it was a 9-0 Democratic city council, a Democratic mayor. They had overspent by $22 million, the city the size of, say, Greeley, Colorado, about 80-some-odd thousand people, and I became the mayor on a platform that would be hard to believe you get elected. The platform was, I'm a financial expert. No one will like anything that has to be done here, but I didn't come all the way back home to live in Detroit. And that was the message that at that point resonated, and I won two terms in a highly Democratic city, and we left the city with $20 million in the bank and a investment-grade bond rating up 8 notches and pension plan assets up 500%. And so we fixed it, and that's what I do. I fix financial problems and work with people to do so. I ran for the U.S. Senate in 2006. I didn't win. I remain, if all I ever do in history, I have this little bookmark in history that among elected officials, elected Republicans, I remain the only elected official to be attacked by the National Republican Party since Abe Lincoln, according to Craig Shirley, who wrote Reagan's biographies. And I moved out here. I moved out here because Rhode Island just couldn't be fixed. It's a very sad statement, but there's places in America that are now gone. They're just not going to come back. And all of America can come back. There's a lot of hope for the future. But Rhode Island's one of them. Highest unemployment in the nation. The guy who ran against me as the Republican is now the Democratic governor. The guy that the National Republican Party wanted, Lincoln Chafee, they thought he was the guy. The guy who's for partial birth abortion. Thinks it's okay to take minors across state lines that you don't know for abortions. The pro-gay marriage, Lincoln Chafee, the high taxes, wouldn't vote for the President Bush. That's the guy the National Republican Party wanted. I wrote a book about it through Penguin Books, the largest book publisher, I think, in the world, called Primary Mistake. And that book resonated with people about the grassroots movement that is needed against the establishment, even within our party, so that we can fix this country. But I came out here, and I couldn't sleep still. I'd driven around the country, by the way, for 3.5 months with my kids, taking a lifelong trip to just on back roads from Rhode Island to Oregon. Stayed in Colorado for a week, and I told my wife, and she told me in 2010, we're just going to go out and we don't have to do this anymore, which was a mistake, And so I got out here. That's how I made the movie. I was at the Sundance Film Festival, and I know that people want to fix this country, and as long as it's fair. The lady at the wishing well will throw in her 2 cents, and everybody else will throw in their money, or whatever has to be done, but they don't believe it's fair anymore. They don't believe that the country's run fairly, and it's starting to get disconnected. And that's why I made the movie Fixing America. But to fast forward to this, when Cory Gardner decided he was going to run for the U.S. Senate, I found out about it on a Thursday afternoon, and quite frankly, like a little mustard seed, I said, wow, gosh. And then the next day, Gary Fernandez was helping me fix my tractor. Quite frankly, he was fixing my tractor. The mice had eaten through the wires. And he said, you're running. These are your people. Like, I've seen your movie. You need to do this. I said, really, Gary? He said, yeah, of course. I went to saw my accountant, Mark, later on that day, about an hour and a half later, and we're done with the taxes. And another thing we could talk about, these crazy taxes. I got these LLCs in my head, just crazy. And so he says to me, I'm writing a check, and you're running. And I said, really? He said, yeah. So I prayed about it and thought about it. And my wife and I prayed about it. We called everybody we knew in Well County, basically, because and then Monday morning, I said, you know what, let's do this. Let's find out that at least in Congressional District 4, do people want to hear the same old stuff? Like, low taxes are great. The country would be great if we had a strong national defense. Or do they want complete solutions that they don't even, many of them don't want to hear about? Because the solutions to fixing America are hard. They're simple, but they're hard. And we don't have much time. This great republic may have 5 to 7 years before financially it blows up. And we all know it. Some people would say 10. Some people say tomorrow morning. But we're living through a time where the events are ahead of the politicians, much like before the Civil War, where they simply couldn't catch up. I'm not saying this is going to be a Civil War. I'm just saying that there are times in history where the people who run the country cannot catch up, and that's where we are today. And I think if there was another time in another place and it was normal, you could send a lawyer, a county commissioner, a state senator, but now you need to send me because I get in people's faces about financial issues, and I get to the core of the problem, and I want desperately to do it for Congressional District 4 and the rest of this nation to be the loudest and clearest voice to fix this country before it's too late. I got 6 kids. The thing that drives me is that I know that they're not going to get the breaks I got. I mean, I live the American dream. I'm the embodiment of some kid who came from nothing, grew up next to a gas station and an ice cream shop on a 50 by 80 lot that made something of himself like millions of people have. And a next generation needs that shot. They're not going to get it if these foolish Republicans and Democrats destroy this country financially and morally, by the way. Anyway, sorry for going on so long, but that's how I got here today.
Well, this movie, Fixing America, you know,
yeah.
I guess the first question that I've got for you is, you drove this whole federation, state, I don't know how many states you covered, whether you went to 48 or 50 or what number.
20-something. Yeah, go ahead.
That you put a lot of miles on, and you had to talk to a lot of people. I'm almost wanting to know more about what ended up on the editing floor. because there had to be a lot of things. There's a lot of things that actually I don't think are in the movie. Obviously, you only have so much time to present, and obviously the territory you covered a lot more than is shown in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess the place to start is why you thought that was a good idea. And the second question, which I'll go ahead and ask now, is what surprised you the most?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, great. This is great. People don't always ask these questions. But what drove me was specifically, I end up at the Sundance Film Festival not to make a movie. I don't make movies, right? Like, just like I don't write books or whatever, right? So I'm at the Sundance Film Festival because 2 individuals called me on the phone and had read my book and said, you're the guy. We're going to start this internet radio just like you're doing here, right? And we want you to run this thing. Help me run this thing. So I said, well, where are you guys? And they were on the East Coast. I said, well, gosh, that's a long way. And they said, well, we're going to the Sundance Film Festival, which is not a long way from here. It's a $70 plane flight from Denver. So I said, why don't I meet you over there? But it wasn't about going to the Sundance Film Festival, but being interviewed on a radio show. Sitting next to the guy who made the movie Margin Call, which is a great movie that no one really saw because Goldman Sachs put part of its fictional account of the collapse of Lehman Brothers with Kevin Spacey and so forth, Jeremy Irons. So these things happened to me. Like, I just knew I'm going to make a movie. And the driving force was that if people could just see this movie, so many people in this country feel like they are alone. you know, if Karl Rove's gang's got $700 million for the next election, and crazy George Soros has got $1 billion, and the average American's got $150, which is what they have, they think, what am I going to do about this? And my experience of driving the country with my children for months at a time and hanging out in, you know, national parks and just on sides of roads, pulling over in Wisconsin and just going to what I thought was a gas station, trying to have a petting zoo in the back, making friends with the owners and spending 5 hours hanging out with them. It's sort of the way I live my life. I just kind of show up and sit down next to strangers and say, hey, how you doing? And so I knew what people thought, but I wanted people to be able to see it. And to know that they weren't alone, that there are people that are different color skin, they're taller, they're shorter, they're richer, they're poorer. And, you know, we can't say on the radio, see on the radio, but the cover of the movie, you know, it's not a cover with Steve Forbes, who's a great guy, by the way, helped me out in the movie, has helped me out in the past, and Grover Norquist, another great guy who's helped me out in the past. They're in the movie, but it's the people. Like, when I stare at these people who are literally sitting on the sides of roads and it just was moving to me to make it, and it took, by the way, a lot of money. It took a year of my life, and you talked about there's hundreds of hours of stuff that doesn't make the cutting room floor. Editing a movie is the hardest thing I've ever had to be part of, because when I'm managing people in the private sector, we're kind of all on the same, you know, investment bankers. We're all going to make a check at the end of the year. And we're all kind of, you know, sort of in unity on some issues. In the public sector, you get the unions you got to deal with, the union leaders. But, man, the agnostic left-of-center movie makers, they're a tough crowd. What surprised me, I shouldn't say surprised, I knew what we'd see, but I really wish that I made a movie or had the extra film of the people that we made the movie with, the 12 or 11 people on the RV in the trail car, who are mostly not conservative, not Christian, and they're with me for months, right? So think about it. Like, after a while, the surprising thing for them, and I'm looking at them, and they're like 3 weeks into making the movie, or 2 weeks, they look at me and go, so when's someone going to say something different? And I mean, we didn't pick out just the scenes that I liked in the movie. Like, they agree with me. All through this country, people do want to fix it. They want to balance the budget. They're happy to suck it up, if that's the term you want to use. Like, they're happy to put all their hands in like a basketball team. But the guys making the movie had no knowledge of this. And so they're like sort of learning on the job, you know, not about editing or film or whatever, but about people. And I thought that was I was surprised that they started to really care so much by the end of this movie that they wanted to make a great movie. They wanted to get these people out there, you know, so that was surprising to me. The other thing that happened, and I'll just tell you, story about this sort of surprising was, since I really didn't figure out the distribution part before I started the movie, I just had to make this movie. So my partner and I, a guy who had a production company, who was a great friend of mine, said, I'm in for half the action, I don't care if we lose all our money, blah, 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 blah. So my partner, Dr. Scholey, and I, we were surprised about the lack, well, we didn't understand the film festival business enough. Finally, there was a guy who won a couple of Academy Awards, I think. His name was Mark Ehrman, I think. And he called me from New York. He had seen the movie. He makes documentary movies. And he says, Steve, this movie is great. I watched it on the plane. I said, well, thank you. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, now we can get it in front of even more people. He goes, well, here's the problem. This movie ain't going to be never going to get into a film festival. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, listen, Sonny and Cher's daughter, sex change operation, that's a documentary movie to those people. He's like, I'm pretty liberal, but a movie like this, and plus you don't attack anybody. You don't go after people and make fun of them. I said, no, of course not. We don't do that. It's not part of the movie. He goes, well, that's what sells. That's what's going to get you. You attack Barack Obama and just call him every dirt name. Or you attack Joe Bush and you put that in the movie with the quality of what you filmed, we'll get that out there. And I said, well, I'm just not going to do that. He goes, well, it's not going to be seen by as many people. And it hasn't been. It's seen by the Christian Television Network, played it twice worldwide, along with my interview for them. And that's, you know, 50 million people watching, but not watching that, probably a couple hundred thousand people watching it. But it's never done exactly what we wished it would do or hoped it would do, in the sense that, you know, but it's part of, I think, the mosaic of either both my life and what has to happen, just this heartfelt, because I associate with these people. I am these people. That's where I come from. So they were surprised at how I could get out of these people, you know, the innermost thoughts, just by pulling up an RV and pulling out waving my arms and saying, here's what I'm doing, here's what we're doing. But because I think they just sense that I'm one of them, most people in America, they were like, yeah, sure, you're actually doing this. And by the way, they were really touched. There's a lady in the movie you've seen, there's a lady named Viola. She's sitting in a chair, and it's a Saturday morning, and they're selling warm pies and old clothes at a church bazaar. And she, when we leave her, I get in the RV and I tell everybody, all 10, 11 people, whatever it is, because one guy's in the trail car, and I said, you know what? Nobody sees this movie. I lose into six figures. I'm okay, because Viola makes my life. That lady had never been asked a serious question that someone meant it, I think, in her life. She was so happy to see someone who really meant, like, what do you think we should do? And her answers were so good, so much better than Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve, just from a guttural level, understanding interest rates, understanding what's going to happen to this country. And she's a lady who drives 50 miles every which way to work, two kids, and she wants to fix America. And so she, you know, I can look at the cover right now and get all choked up, the people that I've met and know now. And anyway, that was a surprise, though. And but it's a meaningful thing to me. And to a lot of people, Crowder out of Christian University has played it. Bill Armstrong loved it, and he played it, the God in the Country Square, God in the Public Square Symposium for a couple of days. And I've been down to Texas showing it. So it's not like people haven't seen it. But it's not one of the ones that the film you know, festivals are going to gravitate to, that's for sure.
Well, I believe your concept of wanting people to recognize they're not alone is certainly accomplished with the movie. And I'm sure that most people out there that watch the movie will get a sense that they're really not alone.
Yeah.
On the other side of this coin, Steve, you're now talking to a group of people that are, most of the listeners for this show are fairly well informed. We've got a lot of deep researchers that follow us, and you know, we bring a lot of people on this show that are deep researchers and really look into the history of things and really have an understanding of what's going on with the spiritual battle. And we talk a lot here about the spiritual battle. That said, when I watch the movie, I have a little bit different perspective on it probably than the average person out there. So I'm just going to share this with you and maybe get some feedback from you. What the movie showed to me was certainly that people are not alone in their feelings, but they are to a certain extent unaware of what's really causing these problems. That they really don't have a real good grasp. They know something's wrong. They know that they're hurting. They want to do something about it. They've got a lot of good ideas, but they don't have a clue that those good ideas cannot be implemented as long as the same people are in control behind the scenes in this Federation.
Yeah, I mean, certainly for the average person in the movie, you know, the person we see going through, they know that the budget should be balanced. I mean, you could hey, right here in Kit Carson, Colorado. I was down there yesterday. I happened to be in Kit Carson, down Cheyenne County, at the same place we were. And the guy in the movie, Carl Anderson, wasn't there where he was, you know, years ago when I pulled in. But, you know, his comment in the movie is, hey, you know, I got to balance my budget. Everybody should balance their budget. But you're right. He works for the city. He owns a restaurant. He's not spending his time on a lot of these issues. He's just frustrated as can be. And there's a line in the movie, I think, that kind of sums this up. There's a guy named Jeff. He's walking. This is down as we get just into Ohio. He's walking down by the river. And he's coming to see what, down the street, and we're trying to get us a good photo of the river. And so we interview him, and he says, you know, paraphrase a little bit, but I've seen the movie 100 times. It's probably about exactly what he says. He says, you know, Republican, Democrat, ain't nobody care about that. We just want people to do the freaking job we put them in there to do. And what he's saying is that he doesn't have time or the understanding to go to the city council meeting, the school committee meeting, the state assembly, the blah, blah, blah. He's got to work. He's got these kids. And so he's trusting them to do what they're supposed to do. Now, they're not doing it. He knows that. But he doesn't know much. He doesn't know a lot more than that because he didn't spend his life the way I spent my life. So yes, there are many people, and that's why this movie, for many of my Harvard Business School buddies, who said to me, "I love the movie, Steve, but man, I thought you'd do even more charts. You're the guy. You're like the Ross Perot guy with the charts and this and that. And that's what you always convince people." And I said to him, "Well, that's not the movie. A lot of people don't know there's really a problem. They don't even know what it is. They don't know what $1 trillion is." It's a part in the movie where you can go watch it at stevelafferty.com or fixingamovie.com, where we go through what's $1 trillion. And a lot of people, when they're done with the movie, there's a part in the movie where we describe $1 trillion. And then we also say that, you know, if you'd lost $1 million a day since the day Jesus was born, you wouldn't have lost $1 trillion till 2734. Like, you still wouldn't have lost $1 trillion. I can't tell you how many people who have called me, emailed into the email, or seen me after they've seen the movie with me when I've shown it, and gravitate to that one point that, like, oh my gosh, is that true? And I'm like, yeah, that's true. And they just don't. $1 trillion is more than the human body has been used to understanding. You know, even for people our age, we grew up with billions. Now it's trillions. And so a lot of it people don't. They don't. It's true. And that, you know, we didn't do a movie, though, about educating people about every little subject and how to go about fixing it in some respects, but it's more of an emotional, heartfelt movie that people do want to do this. So we accomplished that. People watch the movie, and they always say to me, "I had no idea. I really didn't know that these people, like, the representative sample?" I'm like, yeah, this is what you find in between the coasts throughout America, wonderful, great people who really want to fix it and would do it and would love you to do it and help you do it, but they don't know much more than that.
Well, that's a couple of things I want to try to get in tonight before, because I know you've got to be somewhere after 8 o'clock, so we really kind of don't have that much time. We can spend hours and hours talking about really important things on this show. It's kind of funny how fast the time goes. There was somebody long ago, I think it was like a guy named St. Clair or something, that said, "Hell is full of good intentions."
Yes.
And then it became, you know, the road to hell is, eventually it got around to the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But that it wasn't one of the founders that originated that comment. It came from, you know, back in the 12th century or something. But the point is that it seems like campaigns are full of good intentions, and then the candidates end up, whoever wins ends up going to hell because they
all the time
they go over and get severely corrupted or burned out or just crushed or threatened or, you know, whatever. They get controlled one way or another.
Amen.
Let's talk a little bit about your campaign and your situation right now. I'm going to throw some ideas out and challenge me on it. You were kind of a latecomer to this, just like you said. The decision was kind of made recently that you were going to jump in this, but you've got you're very much, seemingly to me, have a lot of anti-establishment ideas. A lot of what you say is very logical. It makes good sense from a conservative perspective. At the same time, you've got three other candidates in the GOP primary right now that are all pretty good people. I mean, we're very fortunate in CD4, which I happen to live in.
Yeah.
We're very fortunate that we've got four good candidates. What scares me about those candidates is that they are really very good people. and I don't know how they're going to deal with the kind of pressure that they're going to have on them. You in this situation are a very interesting situation. If you only had one of those candidates to go up against in the primary, your odds would be greatly reduced. But the fact that you've got three other good candidates that are going to split that vote up gives you the chance to jump in here and actually win this thing. Am I wrong about that? Do you perceive it that way?
Well, I'll let the analysis of the campaign, I'm not very good at. All I know is we all came late to the party because on one day, Cory Gardner decided to run for the U.S. Senate. And so four people entered the race within 48 hours. So there's only so much time to get signatures or go to the assembly or whatever you had to do. And the race is, you know, they're going to count the votes on June 24th, but the race is effectively over a little bit before that, right? Because they're mailing mail ballots out, which I totally disagree with, by the way. I think that as sacrosanct as it can get, everybody should vote on a Tuesday and vote on the same day. And Colorado will wake up one day if someone gets arrested or killed or whatever, you know, after everybody's voted. And they should, and so, but that be as it may, those are the rules, and we'll go with the rules. But yeah, the first point is that the other three candidates are all, I think, wonderful. I mean, I like campaigning with them, and they're good guys and good lady and so forth. So I'm just going to, you know, take my case to the people as best I can in my own strategy. And see what happens. But it is a winner-take-all, no runoff, only Republicans can vote in a Republican primary state. So if you're listening outside the state, that's not true in every state. There are runoff states. There are you know, quasi-open primaries. There are full-open primaries like California where Democrats can vote and so forth. But I think only Republicans should vote in a Republican primary. And so we'll just have to see what happens. But yeah, there are four people in here, so no one will, I mean, I'm guessing nobody will get 50% of the vote. I'll try to. I'd like to. But someone will get less and win with less, that's for sure. And maybe that's a favors some – I don't know. I don't know who it favors, doesn't favor, but I just kind of go, those are the facts in the road, and that's what we got to deal with. And it's a very little amount of time. I mean, I'm not sleeping much, and I'm just – you know, yesterday I drove 550 miles. The district – the people outside of District 4 is about the size of Virginia. And so it encompasses the border of Kansas all the way up to, you know, Nebraska and Wyoming, all the way down to New Mexico and Oklahoma, with three large pots of people living closely together and everybody else on seemingly 20,000-acre ranches, right? It's a great district. I mean, but God had a different plan for me. I wasn't born here. I've been here the least amount of time in Colorado. But, man, it is the greatest group of people that I could ever represent. If I'm so blessed to be able to do it, it'd be so much fun. You know, when I was the mayor of Cranston, Rhode Island, people generally didn't agree with me. It's the most liberal state in the United States of America. Barack Obama, I think, got 65% of the vote in the last election in Rhode Island. So I won two elections there, one which I was not supposed to win, but people put up with me. In other words, and I loved serving them because it was my, you know, it was a great debt to help pay off for the people who helped raise me. My campaign manager was my high school economics teacher who gave me the book Free to Choose. I mean, what could be better than that? Right? He retires to be my campaign manager. I've just been so blessed. But these people in District 4 is where I wish I'd been born. I wasn't born. And I can't imagine anything better than representing it. You know? But how the structure of the race goes, it is what it is, and we'll just take whatever, you know, whatever God gives us. You know, but there are the other people. I'd say it this way, there's no real argument. But we've all agreed that the race is about finances. We've all agreed, and everybody's been taped on statements, that the number one problem is the national debt and the finances of America. And if there was a different time and a different place, I probably wouldn't be running. If everything was okay, I probably wouldn't be running. But this is what I can do now, because alone among the people running, as humbly as I can say it, I'm the one who fixes financial problems. I'm the one who changes votes. I've made every Democrat every year on the city council vote for my budget, and they hated me. I made them vote unanimously to fire unionized crossing guards. I made them vote to take on giant cases against schools that had wastefully spent millions of dollars. They voted unanimously. They hated doing it, but they did it because I brought overwhelming knowledge to the party about how to get this done, and we were right, and we fixed it. Same thing in the private sector. Not a lot of people, you know, people want to argue how to do it. It's my gift. It's what I do. I fix bad financial problems. And you want me, people in District 4, I think, you want to watch on TV somebody who understands the Federal Reserve Board to grill Janet Yellen. You don't want any more to see 10-minute questions that aren't questions, that are self-gratification, things about what a great guy I am. Stop this. You want someone to go find Paul Ryan and say, this is a terrible budget. How are you estimating revenue growing for the government at 4.44% when for 10 straight years with no recession? And bringing that budget to the American people. That's not the right budget. That doesn't balance. We've been growing revenue at 3% for 30 years. So I could go on all day about it, but this is what I do. It's in my book. It's in my movie. It's in my life. And that's why I think we should send me Steve Laffey down to Washington to help fix this problem.
Well, one of the things that I like about these four candidates, including yourself, at least from what I know, is that you're more conservative than the person you're replacing. I was really kind of glad to see Cory Gardner go over and fight against Udall, one, because I felt like he was, and I hate this word, but I'm going to use it, moderate enough to beat Udall. I think he can cross the line a little bit, and the people that are fed up with Udall, you know, anti-gun, socialist, communist, Marxist Udall, the ones that are fed up with him, even the independents, are not going to have too bad of a taste in their mouth with Cory Gardner, because, you know, they're not really getting a real conservative. But we got rid of it. We got rid of that guy. He you know, here's somebody who voted for the NDAA. Here's a guy who voted for some of the bailout stuff. Here's a guy that, you know, really didn't fight against Obamacare the way he should have. There's all sorts of things about – how do you feel about that? How do you feel about what I just said?
Well, certainly, Cory Gardner is not – in other words, conservative or not, but, you know, voting for the NDAA was a bad mistake, and he may have a better chance. I don't know. I don't analyze this stuff. I just don't spend time – a lot of people do. It's just not what I do. I don't spend any time analyzing, you know, how the race is going to go. I just felt in my gut that this is the right race at the right time and in my soul. And if you go to my website, stevelaffey.com, and people should go there, by the way, and people should go to all four websites, and they should ask themselves one question. Who spent a lifetime on this? Who's put out – I mean, you, Ted, you and I wouldn't agree on everything. I've got 25 hours of tape there about how to fix things. And so I'm not afraid to put myself out in the line. And I've got a book out. I got a movie. I got an 11-minute added extra that you can watch for free about balancing the U.S. budget. And nobody will like it. And so that's the difference with me. The other people, they can do what they want. We'll find out. People want the same kind of stuff, which is I don't want to tell everybody everything. And my website won't tell everybody everything. And it'll be some platitudes about we want low taxes. And I'll put a paragraph in there and hope that's all people want. Then I could lose. But I think the man, the messages are coming together now that people, at least in District 4, hopefully the whole country one day, or most of it, are coming to the conclusion we can't do it that way anymore. We're sick of it. We're sick of what people just say and do something different. One thing about me, I've been in an office, and I didn't do anything different. I mean, there's a lot of pressure when you live in the most liberal state. For you to say, well, you know, I just placate those people, whatever. Most people will like it when I don't do this. I don't need to really fire those people. And, you know, I never forget a meeting I had with the fire union. And this is vastly different in Colorado than the East Coast and, you know, New Jersey, Rhode Island. You know, these people run the place, basically, the unions in the public sector. I remember them coming in and after I won an election saying, you know, Mayor, you know, you're going to need us for re-election, and you know, we don't want this guy, Vinny Ragusta, to handle the union contracts. He's a tough lawyer, and we'd rather you do it yourself and negotiate directly with us. And I looked at him and said, I need you for re-election. I didn't need you for election. Like, if no one wants me to do what I'm doing here, I won't do it. Like, this is the lowest paid job I've ever had. I'm not here for the money, guys. I'm not here to move up the ladder. I'm here because I felt a calling to fix my hometown. And I have a calling to help fix America, be one of the people that can help fix this thing. And that's why I'm here. Everything else I leave to somebody else. I just don't much get involved in or think about it. Or just too many things to
Let's talk about the things that you believe are important in this election a little bit, the financial side of it. First of all, a balanced budget, you know, sounds good to conservatives. On the other hand, it really doesn't do anything necessarily about reducing the debt. Nor does it do anything about bringing the reins in on how federal government has exceeded its constitutional enumerated powers. You know, those of us who really are constitutionalists, which is a good percentage of the Republican Party for sure, believe that the federal government needs to be put all the way back into its constitutional box. And that's a far cry further than talking about a balanced budget. So What do you say about that?
Well, yeah, but first things first. If we don't, and I'm not talking about just the budget that we're running at, you know, $600 billion deficit again this year that Barack Obama says we cut it by half because he ran a $1.5 trillion deficit several a couple of years ago, right? But the debt in our country, and people out there listening, everybody's been through this or know someone who's been through it. When people have too much debt, they can't think straight, make lousy decisions, can't sleep at night. Much of our country is not sleeping well at night. And so there are many problems in the country. What I'm good at is the financial side. And so it's not just the debt of this $17.4 trillion, which is, not many people know, is about $13 trillion that we actually borrow off, okay, because some of these intergovernmental department transfers. It's the $211 trillion of unfunded mandates, Social Security, you know, all the things we promised people in the future, giving our demographic part of our country, that will never be paid. And so we've got to be honest about that. We've got to pass a bill about balancing the long-term deficits every year also. But that doesn't get at every single problem, and no one would suggest it does. But it's the number one thing that we can do immediately. And by the way, if we don't get the debt under control and the debt starts going down and we have a country with no debt eventually and we balance the budget every year, if we don't do that, we'll never get to the other problems. The country's gonna blow up financially, Ted. The country, once it gets to $20 trillion effectively, and to make numbers easy for everybody, you know, listening, the Federal Reserve will lose control at some point over keeping rates low. They're not the market. They can do whatever they want. They can keep banks from lending, which is what they do today, which no one knows about. They can do all these things. But at some point, investors look at America and say, I've got to get my money out. And so when we talk about the average of what America's been borrowing at for the last 30 years, it's actually 6%. Well, all you got to do is take $20 trillion and multiply by 0.05 and realize that would be $1 trillion in interest for a country that brings in $3 to $3.2 trillion a year in revenue and spends much more than that right now. So there are other problems. There's many other problems. We can talk about all the other amendments and all the other stuff, whether it's guns. But if we don't get we're borrowing now so low at effectively 2.2% that the national interest every year is about $250 billion. So I'm talking about, in most my friends who do this for a living, it's like, where are we going to get the extra $750 billion from? But that's not even the problem. The problem is that things, even though they may be at an average, there may be an average rainfall in Colorado per year, but the people in the southeast part haven't gotten it in 2 years. So rates just don't go back up to the average and hang out. They go much higher because that's what things do. They move around the average. So rates could easily be at 10%. And the thing that people don't understand in this country, and they have to, we've got to have someone who's a loud and clear voice for this, is that people know that we borrow 30-year bonds, and people know there are one-month bills, and there are notes in between that are over a year. If you ask the average American, what's the average duration of our bonds? People would say 15 years. I've asked people this, by the way. It's not in the movie, but we ask people a lot of these questions. The answer is actually 4.2 years. So the rollover risk of this debt is so high, and the fact that 17, 18 members of the Federal Reserve Board, 435 congressmen, 100 U.S. senators, and a president, especially the Federal Reserve Board, and the lack of courage of congressmen to even question the Federal Reserve Board, even among Republicans, you're talking less than 1,000 people that have put the whole shooting match at risk in this country. Because we're not going to be arguing about the 10th Amendment when rates are 10%. We won't be there. We've got to stop that first and then take each problem as it comes.
Steve, I guess I just need to be really candid. I was a little bit that way with you when we first met. We're not at this position because of incompetence in Washington, D.C. We're in this position because of the people in Washington, D.C. not taking a stand on their oath of office, on the constitutional principles, on the fact that they're supposed to be securing the rights of the people.
Right.
Instead, they're securing their own pocketbooks and protecting themselves and their families from the literal physical threats and bribes and blackmails of the people that are in the shadows. And you can go up there and talk about balanced budgets and doing all the right things logically. And, you know, until somebody actually blows a whistle right off of the roof of the building up there and says, I'm amidst a bunch of liars and thieves here that are doing everything against their oath of office, that don't care about the Constitution, and I'm here to change that and be willing to take whatever the consequences are when they get the pressure from everybody around them. We've got to take control of our media. We've got to get the banksters out of the ownership of our media so that there can be truth put out there to the people so that they can stop being so dumbed down and actually know what's going on, because it's just like the people in Fixing America. These people are getting their information from mainstream media for the most part, and they believe the lies they're being told. Red Beckman, who's on this call, I don't think he's got a live mic because there was some background noise, but Red says that what is more dangerous than the tyrants are the people who believe their lies. And frankly, you know, these are a bunch of good people you've got in this movie, but these people have believed a lot of lies. I know, because I've been there. I've believed a lot of those lies throughout my life before I started really digging into this and discovering what was really going on. So all the logic, all the rhetoric, all the good ideas, until we put certain people in jail, When we start trying some of these people for the treason that they've committed against the people, that's when things are going to start changing. And, you know, we've got some things going on. I really hope that the Arpaio cold case posse thing stops delaying their evidence and brings it out. You know, there's bribes going on right now and then reneging on agreements, even though certain people are bribing people to let them make these positive changes worldwide, really, and they agree to it, and they take the money, they take the bribe, then they send it over to some other account over here, and then they come back and, oh, well, I can't do that. And because they've got so much control of our judiciary and our media and our – and the other thing that we've got to have, we've got to be able to get – proprietary ownership of our currency, we've got to have a sound money in each state, and we've got to have proprietary ownership of the deposits back in the hands of the people. We haven't had that in over 100 years. And until we get that back, we're never going to get redress of grievances on any of these other issues, because all of our production is being stolen through that banking taxing vortex with the fiat currency and the invisible tax of the inflation or devaluation, really, of the paper that we're using in our pocket, which is really not money. Until we start attacking some of these fundamental things, all these other great ideas are going to go nowhere. You got about 12 minutes before you have to leave, so I'll give you the final word.
Well, if I need 12 minutes, but yeah, listen, when it comes to things like the Federal Reserve, all these things, I would just tell you this. There isn't anybody else running for this office. There's actually been an office and tipped the tables over on people, except for me. I mean, you can look at my track record. I am a bulldozer on these issues. So it's not just about balancing the budget, that's for sure. But there ain't anybody else running. I mean, we've got states that are Renfro. He hadn't turned the tables over on the people over there in Denver. I've turned them over on people. I've had people literally follow me around. I've had people start riots at city council meetings to get me out of office. I mean, professional people following me around in front of my house just to follow me. I mean, union goons, and I've never changed. And I came in and I took on all of them. I relished the opportunity to take on all these people, because you're right about this point. The House of Representatives and the Senate are full of really bad people who are there for themselves. You could count on a hand how many people run to try to help the country. I've met them. I've met not all of them, but the ones I've met, Chuck Schumer, I could go all there about these people. So we're going to have to elect more people who are willing to say, you know what, I don't need to be down here for 10 years, 5, 2. I'm just going to go down here and do what I got to do and get as much attention for this cause, which I'm good at, and I've been very good at, getting attention for what I need to get done. I mean, I've, as a mayor of Cranston, I was on the national news a number of times, tipping tables over on people who were sleeping on the job. I videotaped them sleeping on the job. So, no, the process isn't any different. It's just a bigger playing field with a lot more evil people. But I intend to win. I intend to go down there, and John Boehner is not going to be my buddy. I'm a very outspoken guy. I've got my ideas out there on the table, and I'm going to push for them and push for them until I get what we need for the people of CD4 and the people of America. And I'll either drop doing it or people will just throw me out. That's just the way it is.
I understand Red Beckman has an open mic. Red, you've got a live mic. Did you have a question or a comment to make to Steve before he has to go?
Oh, boy.
Hey, Red.
Yes. I'm glad that you let me sit back and listen because I was thinking, you know, here as I was listening, and you see, the founders of this country, they were not just smart people. They were wise men, very, very, very wise. And they understood at that time that perhaps 95% of the people are never going to accept the responsibility of becoming what they should be as far as participants in the whole process. When the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were added in, the Bill of Rights was added in December of 1791, then all 13 of the colonies ratified the Constitution. And history tells us that there were thousands of the people in this, over on this side of the Atlantic, got on the boats and went back to England. They didn't want to be free. They didn't take the time. They didn't analyze the situation. They were so mentally disabled that they were not able to analyze their situation and come to the right conclusions. And so this is where we're at today. We have, and like I heard Terry say that he had believed a lot of lies. Well, I've been around for quite a while, and when I went to the government school, they were teaching me stuff. They called it education, and it wasn't education at all. It was propaganda, and it was propaganda that was disseminated for one reason, and that is so that the wrong people would have control of that 95 or more percent that were mentally crippled to the point where they couldn't think and think properly. And so I see that all. I look back and I remember quite well what I was taught and why I was taught what they taught to us. The founders, they told us back there, Thomas Paine, one of the great motivators of the War of Independence, he said that the democracy is the vilest form of government there is. Well, he learned that because he had read history, and he read what Cicero had said many hundreds of years before how that as Cicero, he was a state a senator in the Roman Parliament, you might say, and he said when the people discovered they can vote themselves benefits from the public treasury, that society cannot survive. And that's where Thomas Paine, you know, where he was able to tap into that wisdom. And we have all these millions upon millions of people out here now that are even more crippled mentally than my age bracket. The people in my age bracket are very much concerned. And I've been running ads, full-page ads in America Free Press here for the last year. I've run a dozen of them and, or so, and we get a good response. But as I analyze those that are responding, I find that most of them are people, a lot of them, are in the same age bracket that I am, and we're not getting any response at all from the Facebook crowd and that. We're not getting any. And so when I go on and the rest of them in my age bracket, what have we got left? It's not very encouraging. I know I see that there are some very strong young people coming up, but we've just had a recent situation in Alaska where we had a young fellow that was a prize winner. I mean, this fellow had been homeschooled, and he had a spiritual base, a foundation. He was speaking out. He was, he recognized the power of the First Amendment, that he had the right to speak out against what we had coming, you know, in the government today. And boy, he was knocked down. They've got him in a federal prison with a sentence of over 25 years. And because the outlaws that want the New World Order, and all they want to rid this planet of about 6 billion of these people out here that don't know wisdom from idiocy or such, and they want to wipe them off the planet. And of course I don't think it's going to happen, but we're at a point in history that is not going to be resolved. The founders gave us a very simple system that in their day, those that didn't get on the boats and go back to England, they understood. And they liked what they heard, and this country, my goodness, how explosive it has been as far as innovative, inventive, and creative powers that have been exercised. It's just unbelievable. It's just really difficult. Here I am. My grandparents on my father's side came from Sweden in 1880, and my goodness, the work that they did, the hard work, the value systems that they had were so great, and here we are. Those values mean nothing today. I'll shut up. I could go on forever.
Yeah, well, listen, I've appreciated you guys having me on. I would tell you this, some final word for me before I have to go. The election's coming up pretty quick, and people got to make decisions in a four-way race and a closed primary with no runoff. And I think that the country has 5 to 7 years left before we really have this financial crisis. And I won't be able to fix all the problems, But I've been in a position to fix financial crises, and that's what I do. And these are not normal times. And the people of CD4, I hope that they want a real fighter to go down there and figuratively, if not literally, turn the tables over on these people that have ruined our country and let people know more. I mean, there's no one else in the race who's written a book, made a movie, spent a lifetime on these issues and knows them, to talk to them about it and to get people to change their votes. So it's stevelaffey.com. If you want to see a real website where someone's putting himself out in the line, go to stevelaffey.com, L-A-F-F as in Frank, E-Y.com, stevelaffey.com. And I appreciate you guys having me on. I really do.
Well, let me,
we appreciate you coming here.
Well, let me give you a recommendation. Go to Google, click on videos, type in Red Beckman, and there will be some programs come up, and there's one there that we did in 1993, 20 years ago, and I'm fairly confident it's getting a lot more hits today than it did back there 20 years ago. And it's still there, and it's still highly recommended by different organizations as being something that people need to learn how our system was designed to function.
I will. I got it right here. Red Beck. I'll take a look at it. But anyway, thank you guys so much.
I hope you'll do, and give us some feedback. Thank you.
Thank you, Red. And thank you, Ted. I'll see you again real soon.
All right, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
God bless you guys. Keep up the fight.
Bless you.
It's not over. All right. God bless.
Okay. Well, Red, one thing we know is that the elections will not solve the problems. We've got to be able to hold. We've got to be able to hold the elected offices, the public offices, accountable in between those elections, and we've certainly got to, as you say in your seminar, get people understanding again that they have the right to judge the law.
Yeah. They just have to learn. The people have to recognize that when we send people to Congress, we're not giving them a blank check. We're not. We are the ones that sign the checks. We're the ones that approve or disapprove of what they're doing. And at least that's the way it was supposed to be. And it wasn't, just the courts. I've got this transcript, of this federal judge in North Carolina. Making the statement, it just every time I read this, I think of this guy. He's been on the federal bench apparently a long time, and more than likely he was appointee by a Republican or a Democrat president, perhaps. But he says, I have to tell you that there are cases where a long course of history, in fact, does change the Constitution. What a statement. there's nothing in that Constitution that gives the courts any kind of a power to create the kind of history that they have and then call it a change in our Constitution. It's just preposterous.
We are really blessed in the 4th District. We've got some good guys that are, and a good lady that are running. It's going to be an interesting race. I just hope that they don't have to make compromises at this point. I want them to all know that the people will support them if they will hold their oath of office and hold true to securing the rights of the people. I keep hearing the economy, jobs, this is The election's about finances. The election's about jobs. The election's about all of it. You know, we're at a point where we've heard this for how many years, and even Reagan grew the national debt as a percentage of the GDP, and he was worshipped. If people really knew what his record really was about and what really went on during his record, they would recognize that he wasn't that great. We need somebody who's going to go up there and really make some changes and turn the clock back in favor of the Constitution and in favor of the people. Now, that will mean that some people actually have to make some sacrifices for a while. It may mean that it may be a little bit difficult, and we may have to suffer through some tough times in order to secure our freedom. But as it is, we've been watching that freedom go down a drain for, you know, generation after generation after generation for the last 160 years.
Yeah, and it's I hear this stuff and everything, and then I'm reminded of when I ran for governor in Montana in 1988, and I didn't take any campaign contributions. I spent $12,000 of my own money. But it was the debates, the television debates, that got my position out there in front of the people better than anything. And one of the things that I had said was, if I were to become governor, I would do everything in my power to visit every public school in the state of Montana. I would, I would have made that my number one project to have, my office set up these appointments to where I could do one public school of a morning and another one in the afternoon where they could schedule an assembly. And, where I could explain how the system was designed to function. But I don't think there was anything that I said that frightened the establishment and caused them to do what they did to make sure that I didn't win. When it came primary day, there were six candidates on the Democratic side, and my whole family pretty well disowned me because the whole family, both sides, my wife and my family, they were all Republicans from way back, and they wouldn't listen. They didn't, they had the same problems that the rest of the people had. When I told them that I was a Jeffersonian Democrat, and of course, if I had it to do over again, I'd do it again, just the same way as I did back then. But the polls in Montana showed me winning the nomination, winning that primary that day, and it was not just my polls, or it was across the board the polls showed I was going to win that Democratic nomination, but both. Fraud was so gross and it was just so unbelievable. I joked about it at the time. I really didn't care. I didn't really want to be governor that much because already I was traveling the nation. I wasn't traveling just the state of Montana. I was traveling, and we had, well, you've seen some of the television, and one time we were doing a television special well, it was being taped in Anaheim, California, in a professional studio, and the fellow was there who was the producer for the Smothers Brothers show. And he was there in the studio and sitting back out of the way watching. And come to find out, he had 3 doctorate degrees, and I think he was a professor. I don't remember for sure whether it was USC, University of California, or one of the other universities there. But he was a professor, and he was the producer of the Smothers Brothers television programming. And these 3 doctorates were in, about the psychology and such, and the difference between, he explained it to me after he came and introduced himself to me after we were done, and he told me, he said, we have found that you can have 2 very good speakers, public speakers, and both of them are very, very effective with a crowd. But one of them will come across like a dud on television, and the other will come across like gangbusters. And he said, we have been trying to figure out how we can determine that without going through all of the trial and error of watching programs and the production and all. And he said, I would recommend to you that you should be doing as much television as you can, because he said, you come across on television. Well, that was the first time I ever heard anything like that, and I guess it's the last time, too. But that's something that he was unable, with 3 doctorates in that lineup studies, he had not been able to identify what it is that makes a difference. I can assure you, I don't know what it would be. I guess I should have used more television. I wasn't crazy about the television. I did a lot of it. I suppose over the years we probably did 50 different 1-hour programs a minimum. I probably got copies of the tape someplace, but I just never. I just never made it a big deal. And I'm not saying that, bragging. I'm saying that because I now recognize, perhaps, that I should have used television a lot more. I know that I think the a couple of the programs that you have watched had an impact on you.
Absolutely. That Red Beckman seminar, I guarantee you, I'm putting together a lecture right now for some patriots in Colorado that I'm going to be doing in a couple of weeks, and I'll be using some stuff out of your seminar in that presentation, with your good permission, of course.
Oh,
and
I'll certainly
give you credit for it too.
I don't own that. I don't own that. That's just common sense and such.
But that your pecking order stuff is really comes home, Red.
It is. It does. It's very good.
Let me say this. I've been watching these elections pretty closely for the last 10 years, particularly, And one of the things that I've been observing is people who avoid, not even necessarily avoid, but don't bother with the caucus process. That they don't even concern themselves with the state assemblies. Because what they do, they have an alternative way of getting on to the ballot for the primary, and that's by collecting a certain number of petition signatures. If you go through the caucus process, you have to get at least 30% of the delegate votes in order to get into the primary. And the person that wins the delegate votes in the caucus process, they end up with their name on top of the primary ballot. Now, if I'd have had time, I'd have gotten into that with Steve Laffey. Steve, because he came in late and he's not really that well-known in Colorado, he relied on the petition process, and so did a gal named Barbara Kirkmeyer. Now, Barbara's a sharp gal. I really didn't know who she was until I heard her speak at the assembly. But the interesting thing is that she went up to speak when she was nominated, and then she declined the nomination so that the other two that had that were going through the caucus process could battle it out in the vote there, but she had already petitioned on, so she knew she was going to be on the primary ballot, the same as Steve Laffey. And in the past, here's what I've seen happen. Walker Stapleton, who's a treasurer of the state of Colorado right now, he didn't bother going through the caucus process, but he was well-funded. So before the primary, he was able to blitz the state with radio ads, and so he had plenty of money to market himself to the general public. So the guy that had won the primary, that had won the assembly, the caucus process, got nailed because he wasn't as well-funded as Stapleton. Now, Laffey's kind of in that same position right now. He didn't raise as much money total as these other guys did, but he hasn't spent it during the caucus process either. So he's got a substantial amount more money available to him to advertise himself going into that primary than the other candidates do. So I'm serious. He's got a good chance of winning, even though he's probably the least known of the candidates, of those four candidates. And there's something wrong with this picture. There's something desperately wrong with this picture. We need to be supporting people who are working the grassroots. If somebody is known and has worked the grassroots and really and grown that support of the people from the caucus process up, they deserve a better opportunity than just somebody coming along because they've got more money and can advertise themselves more on the radio to get elected. There's something wrong with that picture.
Yeah, now, I don't see anything happening very quickly to change the picture.
No, I don't either.
I want to let
the callers know that if you are wanting to ask a question or make a comment, you need to raise your hand by hitting a 1 on the telephone. We had some folks that I thought were going to be, coming in to the show in the second hour, and we're 18 minutes into that second hour, and we don't see any hands raised on the switchboard. So if you're ready to come on, you need to hit a 1 so that our producer, Dr. Kate, understands that you're ready to have a live mic or have a question to ask. So I'm just reminding everyone there, hit a 1 if you want to talk. This is a major problem because if you don't have the money to buy that airtime, you really don't stand much of a chance of building rapport with the people out there listening. because they're not going to dig into it. We have a hand up. Area code 707 should be Doug Millar.
Sir.
How are you doing, Doug?
Fantastic, and sure have enjoyed your program here so far. It's been awesome. And as you know, Ron Egner, he's been listening also. Has he put his hand up yet?
You're the only one that we've seen a hand pop up on that I know of. So.
Interesting. Well,
is he calling from 303?
He's at area code 303. You want his number?
Well, let's not give it over the air. But I know there's been a 303 on the board because Kate mentioned it, but there's been no hand raised. So, Ron, if you're ready to talk, hit a 1, please. Kate's typing me something. Nope. Well, Doug, also now live. Okay. Ron, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds.
You, Doug has a lot of this information that it's nice to have him on with us because he experienced it. Can I say that when I'm speaking on behalf of the Columbine families that lost their children, mainly the ones that are dead, and also a Columbine survivor, Mark Taylor, who unfortunately was a brave young man who stood up to tell the truth. And it turns out that the villain in this is Ken Salazar. So I'm going to try to focus on that, just that part of it. But first, just let me explain to you that the Columbine families were investigating what caused Columbine. And through the smoke and the mirrors and everything, we learned of a rape of the Columbine shooters during an arrest. So that's not common knowledge. But, Doug, go ahead and tell me about how John DeCamp backs this up to his investigation. Doug?
You want me to comment about John DeCamp?
Yeah, tell him about John DeCamp and how he...
Sure.
On public radio saying that the boys were raped repeatedly by law enforcement handlers.
Right. So here, folks, just a little background here. I've been working with John DeCamp since August of 1992. So when the Columbine Massacre took place on April the 20th, Hitler's birth date of all dates, in 1999, I was originally planning to come to the National Rifle Association convention here in Denver, which was starting May 1st, which is today, ironically, for the weekend. And so I arrived here 10 days after the massacre, just in time for the NRA convention, and I already decided to stay here for some time. And we knew that obviously there was involved mind control, and John DeCamp's book, The Franklin Cover-Up, is all about CIA creating Manchurian candidates to go out and kill people. The whole goal of the CIA mind control division is to make sure that the public eventually demands public confiscation of all our guns in America, and it's backfired on big time. So the bottom line is I started investigating what was going on here, and I stayed here for 3 years, and the result was that I spent a lot of time meeting with Ken Salazar and giving him information. He was our Colorado State Attorney General at the time, and he wished me well, but then he went out and was speaking to schools, high schools statewide. I was obviously with campaign for office, and he was lying about the fact that what really happened is he was talking about the bullying of the sports jocks. And so John DeCamp came out here, and I introduced him to two families, he took both of the lawsuits in separate lawsuits, and so he was took the depositions of the Eric Harris's parents, one of the two shooters, and he was able to document many things, and he also had access to the evidence room. He said it was a more secure evidence room and more control over it than at the Oklahoma City bombing, the federal building. And of course, you have to wonder, why was the FBI allowed to be in charge of the investigation of a local school shooting? The FBI had no jurisdiction in the state to investigate a school shooting, let alone in Jefferson County. So, Ron, do you want to continue from that?
The Secret Service was also here to do a profile on the Columbine shooters. Now, this is how easy it is, and realize that the FBI is supposed to be pretty smart people. But in this case, it shows how corrupt they are. We find the written motive in a yearbook entry from Dylan to Eric, in which he writes, "Killing cops, blowing up things. It will be the holy April morning of natural-born killers. This is very important." He says, "My wrath for January's incident will be godlike, not to mention a revenge in the commons." Okay, now what that means is the January incident is the reason that they're going to get even in the commons of the cafeteria by blowing it up. Okay, it was supposed to be a bombing. Okay.
But we
get motive. Then we investigate the January incident, and we find a picture that Harris drew in a file labeled, now this is, you know, a Christian audience, but this is, I'm just trying to be accurate here. The label was WalshButtRape.txt. We were calling it sodomy, but in this case, that's the official name for this picture that Harris drew.
Now, who labeled it that way?
What's that?
Who labeled it that way?
It was some file in, or somebody in an office, apparently. It had been in a notebook, page 2. You can see that it had been in the notebook because it has punch holes in it. It's Pasco County file number on it.
Right.
And it's an official file labeled WalshButtRape.txt.
Right.
So, yeah, wouldn't you kind of want to know what that's about and what's it doing in a Columbine investigative file?
Guys.
Because we have all kinds of other evidence that indicates that this was a race of the two shooters to the point that we would be able to convince anyone at any time that they would take the time to show them our investigation. And we have offered this many, many times to media, to politicians, to, I'll tell you what, when we expose the people that we've been to with this information, and you can see the lack of responsibility. Now understand, I'm talking for people with dead children. I guess that we should be listened to, and instead we get irresponsible answers. For instance, the FBI thinks that the picture looks like a cop walking a dog. We've been to
guys, you guys are very close to the topic you're talking about. You guys have been living it for a number of years. Our listeners have not. I know that you're laying a background right now.
Right.
I think it would be a good idea if you could just kind of tell our listeners where you're going with this. We've got, by the way, we've got 31 minutes left in this show.
Well, what we're going to show is that it was Ken Salazar who framed Mark Taylor when they were covering up the files in which had privileged information, and through that knowledge that he gained by going to those files, going to the depositions, and going to the basement tapes, he is stating that the boys were raped multiple times. We, through a separate investigation, learned through the files that had been released that they were raped on a particular night, the January incident.
Now, hey, Ron?
Yes, sir.
Ron, please let me answer
Terry Dodd's request. Okay, folks, you need to understand that Ken Salazar used those boys' shootings and murders to climb on the bodies of all those dead people, all those wounded children, to campaign for the U.S. Senate. He lied to everybody, and so we're going after Ken Salazar because of the fact that we can help the Clive and Bundy Nevada cattle battle by exposing Ken Salazar as a criminal who should be in jail for lying to the public to get elected to the U.S. Senate. And so Ron came up with the idea that let's put Ken Salazar, who's now a practicing attorney here in Denver in a law office, put him on trial with a common law grand jury and indict him for his criminal activities. And whether we do it legally or not, the fact is that we want to go after Ken Salazar and expose him so he'll never be able to run for political office again because he has been a criminal liar, typical attorney, for ever since 1999 when the massacre
took place. He served as Secretary of the Interior. And put things into place while he was in that position that is leading to all of those ranchers that have been pushed off of their ranches already. I mean, understand that Bundy is just a focal point right now. This is not new. These guys have been at this for a long time. And the same people who have been doing the carrying the water for the banksters are a bunch of perverts, and a good portion of our politicians in Washington, D.C. are perverted in many different ways, and they're the same people who are out here attacking our private property rights. And what you guys are doing is taking it back to some of the things that have happened historically, and personal people who have been, like Mark Taylor, who's been in a political prisoner position, who was put in and held into a mental ward, literally. All of this ties together. Now, next week, we're going to have a panel on here and be talking about the UN and Agenda 21 and the Endangered Species Act. All of what we're going to be talking about next week is all tied back in to what you guys are talking about now. Very few people out there have a perspective that the perversion that went on and the murders that go on and the false flags that go on are by the same cotton-picking people that are creating all the other problems out here economically, pharmaceutically, agriculturally, driving people off their properties. They're all the same cotton-picking, evil, Luciferian people. So I just want the listeners to understand that even though you're talking about details of something that may even seem a little old to them at this point because they've heard about Columbine a lot of times, they need to understand that what you're focusing on is critical and important today just as much as it was back when Columbine happened. So I just want to get that out there. Now take them there. Take them from where you were and bring it up to that.
I know you're interested in Agenda 21, and can I say, having stood up for the Columbine families, I've suffered over 50 Agenda 21 attacks against my property rights. The latest one is this lady, Lily Griego, who's the one that welcomes Obama here when he comes to visit, and she got a trip to the inauguration as one of the 8 outstanding people that have benefited from Obama's campaign. So I know where I'm getting attacked from, and I know how they're doing it. But getting back to Mark Taylor, you can see how they're attacking him. So, yeah, we've got plenty of stories about how they attacked people. And in this case, I've been attacked physically. I've been thrown in jail. Getting back to Mark Taylor, what happened is Mark had learned a great deal because he had filed lawsuits against Solvay Pharmaceutical. That's where John DeCamp came into it. So John gets to go into the files and learn all these things, and it must have leaked out to Mark, because Mark's up standing up saying, hey, wait a minute, the guys who shot me were victims of pedophilia. Yeah, I'm I got stuck in the middle of two guys that got raped and the guys that raped them. So that's all he was doing. He was standing up for the truth. And they drugged him. But too much had leaked out already, and Salazar had his finger on Mark from the beginning. First thing is his lead investigator, this guy Kleinman, Gary Kleinman, was threatening Mark while he was still in the hospital, a SWAT team on the roof. And they passed that off as being somebody's air conditioning repairman. So they wanted to silence him on that. Well, we were right on Kleinman discovering him being part of the cover-up team. So that's all right about time we were there. And then, most importantly, is in order to silence Mark, they had this guy come in and get Mark to sign. Now, one thing, attorneys aren't supposed to be looking for customers because their agendas get in the way of things. But in this case, they used Mark's name to gain standing in a court in which they were trying to seal these files.
Who's they?
Well, it's actually created a panel of three judges that were to decide the outcome. There were the Columbine families that were involved in there wanted them exposed publicly, and then the other choice would have been to seal them. And then Salazar decided he was going to come up with a middle ground because they were trying to satisfy this group that didn't want them destroyed, and he wanted to have a Dr. Elliott review them and then write a report on what he reviewed. And obviously Mark and Donna would not have been interested in that. They did not know Dr. Elliott. And this was Salazar. Salazar actually got 19 attorney generals to sign on as friends of the court. And if you just study one document, you can see how they framed Mark in order to seal those documents. And it was shortly after that is when Mark got been drugged, because they didn't want him coming out saying, wait a minute now. So he never did get his opportunity to say, wait a minute now, because they grabbed him and drugged him. But we followed this back to the exact time that Mark was drugged. Now, see, what people don't understand is Mark was also going out working with a Dr. Ann Tracy about the dangers of psychotropic drugs. So everybody wants to think, well, they drugged him with the same drugs that he was talking against. No, that sounds convenient. No, it was Salazar's goons, because we know them to be goons. We did profiles on them. Yeah, Google Gary Kleinman, Don Estep, and then you can kind of do your own, somewhat of a profile, just because you'll find Steve Garten, who's done a profile. But yeah, we know what we're talking about here. Matter of fact, we even have the depositions of the killer's parents, Harris's, and we've offered them to the Denver Post. For some reason, they don't want this information. And it obviously talks about the what they're calling the van incident, the January incident. That's why it's called that, as the boys call it the January incident. But anyway, just study January incident, and you'll learn what Adam Lanza learned. Here we go again. We learned that Adam Lanza was a Columbine copycat who was obsessed by Columbine, and he too was raped. And if you want to know if he was raped, you simply have to Google, I am Adam Lanza, I will be famous. And then he basically has a statement there where he says, your idyllic life did not include me being raped by perverts. So we're running into a FBI that doesn't seem to think that the sexual experiences of these children have anything to do with them picking up a gun and going to school, and we're seeing it quite differently.
Guys, how does this tie into the Bundy situation?
Well, it turns out that the Interior Secretary fast-tracked that, Ivan Poe solar plant seemed to be... He was real cooperative. They didn't have to deal with the tortoises on that project. It didn't seem to be that they were in the way at that point. So we just have to understand that the Bundys have the same issue. It just so happens that the man who rose to the top of that garbage they're looking at happen to get there on the lies about pedophilia and how it affected our lives. Because we don't appreciate a government that thinks they're going to cover up the rape of a couple boys that went and caused a horrible tragedy like this. And in fact, when we yell rape, they're required by law. Yeah, there's some zero tolerance laws built in where when you say that you know the rape of a minor child, they're supposed to investigate it. And we haven't had that happen.
Well, Ron, let me just address what Terry is talking about here.
Okay.
For people that have not read the book, The Franklin Cover-Up, by John DeCamp, who was one of the 8 most decorated presidential Vietnam veterans in the entire war, and he was in the CIA, not by choice, but he was ordered to change from the Army to the CIA while he was in Vietnam. And so consequently, DeCamp's best friend for 25 years and his mentor was Bill Colby, who eventually became the head of the CIA. And those two men, DeCamp and Colby, decided to write that book, The Franklin Cover-Up, because of the fact that they had helped create a monster, a Frankenstein monster, the CIA, and they had to bring it down because the CIA had so many pedophiles in it, sodomizing children and creating Manchurian candidates, child sex slaves, et cetera, et cetera. And so they, in the book, The Franklin Cover-Up, DeCamp was told he needed to write it by Colby when they had their meeting with their wives, and DeCamp spent the whole weekend in a motel room and wrote the whole book in one weekend. Now, the point is that in his book, he exposes the CIA, but he also exposes the FBI, because the FBI has been protecting the CIA's pedophiles nationwide for many, many decades. In fact, since the CIA was created in 1947, that's what we, and I studied to be an FBI agent when I was in high school and college. I spent 2 years in college trying to become an FBI agent before I couldn't afford to go back to school. And so the result is I've always been very supportive of people in law enforcement who support the Constitution. But when they go after children and protect people who are sodomizing, torturing, and murdering children, as the FBI has done nationwide for decades, and you can read the Franklin Cover-Up to get the documentation, we have to draw the line of the sand, and we have to expose these people, because most of the people in the FBI and CIA are good people. When they join, they haven't got a clue what they're getting into, but the fact is that most of their leaders are now either pedophiles or pedophile protectors, and therefore, that's why Colby risked his life and lost his life trying to help expose the CIA, which he helped create, because he was a World War II veteran in OSS. So to bring this forward now, that's why I'm working so closely with Ron Egner. I've known him since the first anniversary of the Columbine Massacre when I met him there. And I've stayed in his home several times, and he's a good man who's a national authority exposing the truth about Columbine that the FBI has been covering up for the last 15 years.
Okay, guys.
So, this was all back in the Reno days, okay? There was a secret meeting 3 days after Columbine where Reno showed up. This magistrate that tried to cover up the tapes was a magistrate that was appointed by Clinton days after it happened. We know how the corruption on that regime was rampant. And in this case, I had the opportunity, the Columbine families brought me there for the intent and purpose of what I did, and that's a meeting that we had with President Clinton. Doug, you've seen the pictures and everything. You'll vouch for me that the meeting took place. And in this case, my goal in that meeting was to explain it to President Clinton what we had learned to that point. And so I explained to him what we believed that picture that Harris Drew.
Gosh.
And then we also told him that we had the written motive, so I explained to him that it was about wrath over the January incident. That's pretty clear when you realize that Dylan wore the word wrath emblazoned across his chest as he was killing students. So anyway, getting back to that, I did this in front of the entire group of Columbine victims that were gathered in this room to meet with the president. And I'm sure there's probably a video of it in the Clinton Library someplace, but don't need it. I mean, I've got enough proof just to fax to people to let them know I did this. So
it goes beyond
Salazar. It goes all the way to President Clinton, the way we see it. Kind of rude to ignore people that have dead children. You know what I'm saying? We just found
it goes beyond. It goes beyond President Clinton.
Oh yeah,
big time.
It goes really above President Clinton are people like H.W. Bush, Kissinger, Rockefeller. Those guys are all part of the Herbert Hoover Club.
I've got some vids on Maurice Strong, so that's where I understand the problem is.
Let's bring this back to Salazar for a second. The Interior Department is over the Endangered Species Act, the enforcement of that, as well as the BLM.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if you're going to come after Salazar, you better have your ammunition really sound. So the question is, where's the tie-in to conclusively tie Salazar to the corruption and cover-up that's going on?
The tie-in, as far as what he did at Columbine, or are you talking about what he's doing right now? I want to know
what evidence somebody can look at and say, absolutely, there's no question that Salazar was involved in this.
You know, I don't know how you go about getting the truth out. Doug mentioned that we could just have a trial and put it on YouTube, but in this case, to say the information is out there for those who are interested that Salazar committed a horrible crime in the abduction of Mark Kaler, in the way he used Mark Kaler in a fraudulent way in order to seal those tapes. In that case, we could get the tapes exposed, and all this would be laid out on the table, and then we would put handcuffs on Ken Salazar to lead him off, because, can I say, we can even prove it without the tape, because we went to Ken Salazar personally, okay? I witnessed this through the fact that I approached Ken Salazar and said, what is this about you not letting Donna Taylor into the grand jury room? And can I say, it goes to Sandy Hook, too, because we weren't invited to the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission either, even though co-conspirator Bill Ritter was there as a keynote speaker. So I'd have to say there's something really, really wrong with the way information is being passed around, because we are the families of dead. Yeah, they're never going to get alive again. They're dead. So we're not real happy with the way things have been handled when we've learned that they're dead because of cops that rape children. And it doesn't make us real popular in our neighborhood because the cops don't really like us.
Yeah, understood. But you're also going to have some more people not liking you if you're trying to point the finger at somebody like a Salazar. You've got to give them a good amount of verifiable kind of stuff that they can go see. If it's out there on the web, don't just say just go look on the web. Let's give them a website or somebody that's researched it.
Doug, for anybody that's listening, why don't you give you email address, and then I'll forward any information people would like to know, and particularly this one article that was in law.com. It just sticks you right in the face of what they were doing to Mark Taylor in that one article. They have this joker, Jones, claiming that he didn't give the right instructions to these three judges so that they could actually investigate it. So the judges made a decision, not even seeing, we're making a decision on. And then,
hey,
you know.
Gary, I want to add something to what Ron was talking about, because of the fact that as soon as he and I started talking to you about doing a simulcast on your program, his Ron's website, Columbine Family Request.com. I repeat that, Columbine Family Request.com, has been crashed after he's had over 3 million hits on his videos and his other reports there as of 2 years ago. And so,
learned that the Columbine shooters are raped is because he was on our website and his online name is Smiggles. So obviously he knew that the Columbine shooters are raped, and so was he.
Remember, we're trying to stay focused on Salazar this time around. So let's stay focused on him for the next 10 minutes.
So where can people go and get the information?
Should have been ColumbineFamilyRequest.org, but I guess they decided to take it down, so it's been down over a week now, and we can't seem to get it back up again, but there's a huge amount of information. So if you, at this point, type Release Mark Taylor, and that'll give you some information.
Release Mark Taylor, huh? Now, Mark's out now, isn't he?
No, he's not. I'm able to get him out. Even 7 days in a row now. It started off as 1 day and then two, and so I've got it up to seven. He actually
so are they still drugging him?
Yes, they are. And his health has gone downhill. Donna has now reached the point where she's no longer able to help Mark. He's pretty much, can I say, he has no support from her any longer.
She was up in Las Vegas desert, and they put her in the hospital and started drugging her, and now she's dysfunctional as of a year ago.
Yeah, that was about when I talked to her. It was about a year ago, and she was definitely not the same person that I'd talked to a year earlier than that.
Right. And so now they're drugging both Mark Taylor, who was shot 7 times and had 13 bullet holes in him. He's a walking miracle to be alive, and he was the most outspoken person at Columbine, including any mill parent was as outspoken as he was, exposing what really happened at Columbine and also what needed to be done to solve the problem of drugging all these millions and millions of children with so-called SSRI drugs. It turned a lot of these children into killers as teenagers. And
who specifically gave the orders for him to be hospitalized and drugged? Does anybody know that?
They simply grabbed him and drugged him. There was no law that they even followed. They could have only kept him for a 72-hour, but yet they just simply kept him. He never had a trial. False accusations that he had planned to blow up a bookstore, but we all know Mark is being a real gentle guy. Never would have even thought of such a thing. So yeah, he was trained, and he's a political prisoner. So we're not going to.
Is it releasemarktaylor.com or .org or what is it?
Well, just Google.
Free.
Best way to go there. There's a Facebook page, has a lot of information that I posted on, but surely the Columbine Family Request website isn't the only website that has been taken down. Mark's webmaster had a pre-Mark Taylor website, and when Hickenlooper's office discovered it, and it had all the information about it even had a some footage. Now, when I say this, I apologize again to our Christian audience, which might offend them, but be accurate. It had a video of Eric Harris being taunted about being raped. It goes like this. Hey, Eric, you got jacked up the ass, like that, and it does it twice. And you couldn't have helped but just look at it. It was an autoplay. And it was on a website that it had Hickenlooper's picture on it with the caption, gee, why are you allowing Mark Taylor to be held against his will in a Colorado mental institution? Well, when Hickenlooper's office found this, he called Hoyt's office because Hoyt was being also had an autoplay on it, and took his website off, threat of a legal action against Mark's attorney, who was simply trying to help Mark get free. And so it lets you know that Hickenlooper, you know, needs to be exposed. He doesn't help anyone. We've got so many politicians that we've been to, and we've got a story about every one of them. Right now we have somebody embedded with the Tancredo campaign. Remember Tancredo? He was the congressman, lived in the Columbine neighborhood. Okay? So, yeah, when we expose all this and the people that think that they're going to get away with it, it's going to go way beyond Salazar. And I think the politicians in this state need to be shaken up a little bit because we're not going to stand for any more of this. Well, by not coming out with the truth in the first place. And truly, the reason that was is because they had an opportunity to serve a search warrant on Harris's house, and they gave the excuse that it was just a big mistake or whatever, like they were Keystone Cops. No, had they served that search warrant, then it would have given Eric Harris an opportunity to appear in court. And they didn't want that to happen because then the pedophilia would have come out. So they were covering up pedophilia prior to Columbine and trying to handle them on the outside. And apparently, according to John DeCamp, trying to use trauma-based mind control on them.
Doug, we're down to 2 minutes. You want to wrap this up so our listeners can get a conclusion to this?
We'd like a hand in protecting America's children because our information will expose them as being people that shouldn't be trusted with your children. Wake up. If they're going to hide the rape of Eric and Dylan, there's no place for rape children to go, and there isn't.
Right.
Our experience lets you know that rape children have nowhere to go.
And last week, Ron sent me a 20-minute video where Alex Jones says, I need to talk to John DeCamp. And the title of his 20-minute video is Pedophiles Rule the World. People, wake up. Let's take our country back nonviolently. We got to protect everybody's home. Terry, you want to close with prayer?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Ron, do you want to close with prayer?
I'll close us.
Okay, good.
Father in heaven, we recognize you as the only self-existent one and the only one that's going to truly bring justice on this earth. We look forward to the day when you decide to put a stop to the perversion and the corruption and the abuse that's been going on, especially of the children. And Father, we just we pray that you would put a stop to it sooner rather than later. Work through us. Help us to inform people. Help us to reach out and help those that are being victimized by these perverts. We want to have freedom, and we know that we can only have that freedom if we're in your presence. Because outside of your presence, Father, there is so much deception, so much lies, so much confusion. And we know that we need your power and your strength and your courage to face this and to take action against it and to stand against it. We know that you love us, and we know that you want what is best for us. And this has gone on long enough. We need your help. We ask for it. We depend upon it. We trust in it. In the name of your Son, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen.
I regard myself as a soldier.
Good night, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us.
We
folks, next week for Walls in Our Minds. It's going to be a very special show. Tom Weiss will be our featured guest. We'll have Michael Bednarik on here. Kurt McKenzie will be joining us. Kate will be joining in the panel discussion next week. It's going to be a pretty big show, so make sure you're here next week, folks. Bye.
Sailors' dirty lips, they rule the night, they rule the night. Don't be afraid of the wicked men, there's more of us than there are of them. Come join the politics.